This is .NET Cast with hosts Mark Baker and Nick Hemdahl.
Sign up for the SD Expo mailing list to receive conference updates and the 2006 conference catalog. Go to www.sdexpo.com.
And now introducing your host for .NET Cast, Mark Baker.
Welcome to .NET Cast. I'm your host, Mark Baker. Thanks for joining us again. With me tonight is my co-host, Nick Hemdahl. Hey, Nick.
Hey, Mark. We're going to have another great show tonight on .NET. And don't forget, you can always find us on the web at www.ddj.com/podcast/.NET Cast/.
In this episode, my co-host Nick Hemdahl starts off asking Brian Noyes about key technologies that he's seeing used in smart client applications.
What technologies do you see are you implementing the most in those given scenarios? I know there's some new stuff in the .NET 2.0 framework for detecting offline, online type things.
Yeah, the stuff in the framework is, and I usually demo this in a session I give on offline apps, the stuff in the framework helps a little bit, but it really is only the first inch of the mile. The stuff that's in the framework, all it will let you do is it's an event model. It's the network interface class. It has an event that will be raised that will tell you if you are online or offline. But their definition of online or offline here is just simply basically have you been issued an IP address by somebody or do you have an active IP address on the network. It does nothing about whether you can actually talk to your back-end system over a web service or database connection or whatever. So the mobile worker could have just fired up their wireless on the customer site and somehow got issued an IP address but not be allowed out through their proxy.
What about things like the offline application blocker?
Even that, it's just using that same capability under the covers as far as detecting online or offline. If you really want to know whether you can do anything meaningful based on being online, you have to kind of design that into your API. So you have to, first you can detect, first am I on a network so that I can sensibly make an attempt to connect, but then you pretty much always have to expose some sort of an endpoint from your back end that lets you make a request and say, can I talk to this web service? Does it exist as far as my client is concerned? And then once you've established that remote connectivity to your back end, then you can start pushing data back and forth and so on. And there's no prepackaged solution for that. It's just typically the way you handle that is you expose a simple, connect check, kind of a ping type operation on your web service or whatever your remote service is to say, can I talk to you? And once I've established that, now I can go on about my business.
Out of curiosity, what kind of position do you have on TDD and like designing for testability with smart clients and those things? I mean, with logging and exceptions and those types of things, what do you think about that?
Sure. I just laughed because it's like there's always, one after another thing that become these religious wars. It's either what language should you use or is it web versus smart clients or, whatever the data sets versus custom objects, and TDD seems to be the religious debate of the day.
Yeah.
My position on this is I have not quite personally bought into the full concept of test-driven development, which usually, for those who are into it, the full definition says that you write your tests first and then you think about what your objects need to be based on the way you design your tests. I tend to design objects first and then write tests around them. I'm an absolute proponent of unit testing and having a good, rigorous unit testing approach to things and making sure you test everything that you write, but I typically write my tests after I have designed the main API. And the thing, I had a great discussion on this with Scott Bellware, is a well-recognized expert in TDD. He was up at DevTeach in Montreal a couple weeks ago, and we had a great discussion on this because, there's different ways of approaching the same problem, and to a certain degree, the pure TDD approach is doing the same thing that we do in a different way. So we're at iDesign, we're big proponents of interface-based programming, meaning the first thing you do when you go to design a component, a logical object that you're going to implement, is you think about what is the interface to that object going to look like. And in the .NET world, you define that as an interface construct, and you say these are the methods, properties, and so on that I'm going to have on this object before I write any kind of code that sits behind it. And that's really, when TDD people talk about one of the main benefits of doing TDD, besides just making sure you have your tests in place by the time you actually write your code, the other big advantage of TDD is forcing you to think about upfront, how am I going to interact with this object once it's written? And that's really the same thing that interface-based programming does. It just does it in a different way. Interface programming does it through thinking about that abstraction layer as an abstraction layer and defining it that way. TDD just does the same exact thing in the form of writing tests that call the interface, so you're sort of defining the interface by calling it instead of just defining the interface in isolation and then writing code that implements it. So I understand the motivations behind TDD. They make sense to me, but I just find it somewhat unnatural to actually start writing code against an interface that hasn't been defined yet. Mm-hmm. I prefer to define the interface first, then define the implementation that sits behind it, and then write the unit tests that exercise it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the challenge there is to keep from thrashing your unit test because you keep changing your, you know, interface or your implementation definition. So maybe your parameters are changing to your methods or whatnot.
Right.
And you have to keep going back in unit test and rewriting it because the test you originally wrote does match up with your final or your interim implementation.
Exactly.
So you end up spending a lot of time sort of bouncing back and forth.
Yep. And, you know, I've heard it argued both ways. The people who are into TDD will defend it vigorously, and it seems to work for them. I just haven't quite wrapped my mind around doing it that way, and the way we do it seems to work, so I haven't had much motivation. It is a major paradigm shift. And the other big aspect of TDD is you pretty much have to have a number of motivated individuals who want to give it a try and convince the whole team.
Right.
If you can't have the whole team do it, then you can't do it at all.
Well, one of the things you mentioned in your list of definition or attributes that go into it making a smart client was automatic update. And with .NET 2.0, that's called ClickOnce, and it's, I guess, brand new stuff that people can now take advantage of to automatically update their applications. But you spent a lot of time on ClickOnce out there in the field talking with people and at conferences and whatnot. So why don't you give us sort of an intro? What is ClickOnce all about, .NET 2.0, and how does it differ from something like the updater application block that came from the PHP?
Yeah, these are both ClickOnce and updater application block are sort of your two primary choices these days for how am I, you know, if I go out and I design this rich client application that's designed to work distributed and run securely on the desktop and so on, you know, the final mile problem in the past has always been, now I've got an enterprise with 10,000 desktops in it, and I got to go run an installer on 10,000 desktops, and that becomes intractable for IT administrators, especially when you start thinking about, you know, a dynamic environment where if you have that enterprise that's spread across the world, you can't count on everyone being offline at, you know, 2 a.m. at given local time to do the update all at once. And so it gets complicated if you have to rely on Windows installer technology to get those things pushed out. And so what ClickOnce was designed to do is try to address that aspect, the thing that was the final limiting factor on why on these big enterprise applications, usually people chose to do it as a web app because they could just walk up to a single server, drop some files on there, and they were done with their deployment. So what ClickOnce tries to do is give you that same maintenance experience for smart client apps. And what it allows you to do is you design your app, get it all ready to go, and it's basically the same thing. You walk up to what's called the deployment server, and you drop your application files, the executable for your Windows Forms app, any DLLs that it references, any support files, maybe JPEGs, XML files, config files, and so on. You just drop all those on a single server or maybe a farm of servers, and you create two additional files, which are called manifests, a deployment manifest and an application manifest. And drop those in the same location, and you're pretty much done from an administrator perspective at that point. And then what happens is you give out a link to all of your end users. So from an end user perspective, the advantage here is twofold. One, they get the same ease of use that they're used to with web apps. If they have an address, they can use the app. So so they just need a URL. You can send it to them in an email. You can put it as a link on a portal website, something like that. And, you know, they don't have to keep track of the difference between a Windows application and a web app. They just click on the link and good things happen. The other advantage from the user's perspective is just the fact that now they're, when they do click on that link, instead of just interacting with the browser application, now they're going to be interacting with a smart client once it's automatically deployed to their desktop. What happens at that point is they click on the link, click once on the client machine, so it does require that the .NET Framework 2.0 is installed on the client machine, and there's a way to do that in a click once-like fashion we can talk about. But once the .NET Framework 2.0 is on the client machine, they click on this link that points to those files on the deployment server, then click once on the client machine, basically pulls down all the app files, puts them in a cache on the client machine, and runs them from there. And so from the user's experience, as the name implies, the idea is that it should be a click once on a link and the app is up and running on their desktop. Now, it's not quite that simple. People like to joke about the fact that for most apps, it's really click twice because they click once on the link. And then for most apps, because of the security model, it's going to prompt the user and say, hey, this app wants to do privileged things, such as make a web service call or access a database or access your file system. And that's that running securely on the client machine aspect of a smart client. There's two models that ClickOne supports. One is prompting the user, and one is doing it automatically based on a administrator configuration called a trusted publisher. But through one of those mechanisms, it will elevate the privileges, and the default model is to prompt the user. So usually you're going to get this click twice where they click once to start the launch process, and then they have to click again to say, yes, I want to install that app and let it run.
So File.io is a no-no out of the box with click once. What about things like IOTA isolated storage?
Isolated storage you can get away with. These things, basically what they all rely on, they're using the existing infrastructure that's been there since .NET 1.0 for code access security, and they're looking at the URL that the user uses to launch the app to figure out what would that app be allowed to do based on that launch zone. So there are these predefined code groups in code access security that are tied to zones, specifically the My Computer zone, the local intranet zone, and the internet zone. And it looks at the URL and says, which one of these zones is this app being launched from? What set of permissions would it be given by default based on that launch zone? And if it needs to do anything above and beyond that, then I need to elevate the privileges somehow, and that's where it either relies on prompting the user or using this trusted publisher mechanism I mentioned. So by default, most apps are going to be launched by through either the local intranet zone, through something like a --machine name type of address, or just an HTTP machine name address on the local intranet, and that will evaluate to that local intranet zone. Or if basically what it boils down to is if there are dots in the server part of the address, then it says that's internet, and it will use the internet zone. But either one of those zones, you can't do file I.O., you can't do database access, you can't even call out over the web to anything other than the server that you came from. So it's very limited permissions that are going to be granted by default.
So, I mean, where does it actually run, the application?
That's where there's a certain amount of magic there. In the launch mechanism, click once, it is actually running from the local machine under the user's profile. So the click once deployment mechanism copies all the files from the deployment server into a cache under the user's profile. It's buried down under local settings, apps, and then some obfuscated directories that create similar to isolated storage. So it's buried down there under the user profile on the local machine, but it does not treat it as if it's running from the local machine. It treats it as if it's running from that remote location that you launched it from.
Out of curiosity, how do I roll back? You know, like, I mean, if I'm a publisher or something like that,
Okay. There's kind of two answers to that. From a user's perspective, there's an ability to roll back. So when you install an application through click once, say you've got a nice stable version of your app up and running on the desktop that you deployed at some point in the past, and then you get prompted and say, hey, there's a new version available, and you say, great, give it to me, click the OK button, and now the app starts crashing on you. ClickOne supports a rollback mechanism from the client, so there's an item added to your Ad Remote programs that you can either fully uninstall the application or you can roll back to the previous version.
That's nice.
So the client themselves can drive that if the publisher did not deem a given version as a mandatory version. So you also have control as a publisher to say, hey, I'm pushing out this new client, and the reason I'm pushing it out is because I just updated all my server-side interfaces, and that old client's not going to work anymore. So for that scenario, you don't want the client to be able to roll back, and you can deem a version a minimum required version and make sure that they get forced to take the update and that they can't roll back to the previous one because it won't work anymore. The other option you have as a publisher, if you want to roll back, do basically conceptually a server-side rollback to say, oops, I pushed out this buggy version and I want to push them back to the previous version if they're not smart enough to do it themselves. All you really do in that case is on the server side, you publish a new version. And the new version is just a new version number, but it points to the old version.
Gotcha.
And so the next time they run, you can make it the minimum required version if you want to. So it'll be a new version number, but it'll point to the old files. And if you make it the minimum required version, then they get basically forced back to the previous version, which was not buggy. So you have a fair amount of control over those situations through the versioning policy.
Well, that's all for this episode of .NET Cast. Send us an email at .NETcast@sunburstsoftware.com and let us know what you think of the show. Take care, everybody.
The opinions expressed on .NETcast are solely those of the participants and not necessarily those of its sponsors or CMP Media, its partners or employees. .NETcast is a CMP DevNet podcast and is produced by Sunburst Software at sunburstsoftware.com. Additional production support has been provided by Digital Context at digitalcontext.com. CMP DevNet is solely responsible for the content of .NETcast.
Sign up for the SD Expo mailing list to receive conference updates and the 2006 conference catalog. Go to www.sdexpo.com.